Chapter 44. "Got a minute, Dan?" Curtis Mayo asked as Dan Fawcett got out of his car in the private street beside the White House. "You'll have to catch me on the run," Fawcett replied without looking in Mayo's direction. "I'm late for a meeting." "Another heavy situation in the Situation Room?" Fawcett sucked in his breath. Then, as calmly as his trembling fingers would permit, he locked the car door and picked up his attaché case. "Care to comment?" Mayo asked. Fawcett marched off toward the security gate. "I shot an arrow in the air." "It fell to earth, I know not where," Mayo finished, keeping step. "Longfellow. Want to see my arrow?" "Not particularly." "This one is going to land on the 6 o'clock news." Fawcett slowed his pace. "Just what are you after?" Mayo took a large tape cassette from his pocket and handed it to Fawcett. "You might like to view this before airtime." "Why are you doing this?"
"Call it professional courtesy."
"Now that's news." Mayo smiled.
"Like I said, view the tape."
"Save me the trouble. What's on it?"
"A folksy scene of the president playing farmer. Only it isn't the president."
Fawcett drew up and stared at Mayo.
"You're full of crap."
"Can I quote you?"
"Don't get cute," Fawcett snapped. "I'm in no mood for a slanted interview."
"Okay, straight question," said Mayo. "Who is impersonating the president and vice president in New Mexico?"
"Nobody."
"I've got proof that says otherwise. Enough to use it as a news item. I release this, and every muckraker between here and Seattle will crawl over the White House like an army of killer ants. Do that and you'll have a dozen eggs on your face when the president stands as close to you as I am and denies it. Not if I find out what sort of mischief he's been up to while a double played hide-and-seek down on the farm. I won't wish you luck because the whole idea is outlandish."
"Level with me, Dan. Something big is going down."
"Trust me, Kurt. Nothing off-limits is happening. The president will be back in a couple of days. You can ask him yourself."
"What about the sudden burst of secret cabinet meetings at all hours?"
"No comment."
"It's true, isn't it?
Who's your source for that little gem?"
"Somebody who's seen a lot of unmarked cars entering the sub-basement of the Treasury Department in the dead of night."
"So the Treasury people are burning the midnight oil."
"No lights go on in the building."
"My guess is they're sneaking into the White House through the utility tunnel and congregating in the Situation Room."
"Think what you like, but you're dead wrong. That's all I have to say on the subject."
"I'm not going to drop it," Mayo said defiantly.
"Suit yourself," Fawcett replied indifferently. "It's your funeral."
Mayo dropped back and watched as Fawcett walked through the security gate. The presidential advisor had put up a good front, he thought, but that's all it was, a front. Any doubts Mayo might have entertained about sinister maneuvers emanating behind the walls of the nation's executive branch were swept away. He was more determined than ever to damn well find out what was going on. Fawcett slid the cassette in a videotape recorder and sat down in front of the TV screen. He ran the tape 3 times, examining every detail until he knew what Mayo had caught. Wearily, he picked up a phone and asked for a secure line to the State Department. After a few moments, the voice of Doug Oates answered through the earpiece.
"Yes, Dan, what is it?"
"We have a new development."
"News of the president?"
"No, sir. I've just had a talk with Curtis Mayo of CNN News. He's on to us."
There was a taut pause.
"What can we do?"
"Nothing," said Fawcett somberly. "Absolutely nothing."
Sam Emmett left the FBI building in downtown Washington and drove over to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. A summer shower passed overhead, moistening the forested grounds of the intelligence complex and leaving behind the sweet smell of dampened greenery. Martin Brogan was standing outside his office when Emmett walked through the anteroom door. The tall ex-college professor offered an outstretched hand.
"Thank you for taking time from your busy schedule to drive over."
Emmett smiled as he took his hand. Brogan was one of the few men around the president he genuinely admired.
"Not at all. I'm not a desk man. I jump at any excuse to get off my butt and move around."
They entered Brogan's office and sat down.
"Coffee or a drink?" Brogan asked.
"Nothing, thanks." Emmett opened his briefcase and laid a bound report on the CIA director's desk.
This spells out the Bureau's findings until an hour ago on the President's disappearance. Brogan handed him a similarly bound report. Likewise from Central Intelligence. Damned little to add since our last meeting, I'm sorry to say.
You're not alone. We're miles from a breakthrough, too.
Brogan paused to light a rope-like Toscanini cigar. It seemed oddly out of place with his Brooks Brothers suit and vest. Together the men began reading. After nearly 10 minutes of quiet, Brogan's expression softened from deep concentration to curious interest, and he tapped a page of Amit's report.
This section about a missing Soviet psychologist.
I thought that would interest you. He and his entire United Nations staff vanished the same night as the Eagles' hijacking.
Yes, to date none of them have turned up. Could be merely an intriguing coincidence, but I felt it shouldn't be ignored.
The first thought that crossed my mind is that this... Brogan glanced at the report again. Lugovoy, Dr. Alexei Lugovoy, may have been assigned by the KGB to use his psychological knowledge to pry national secrets from the abducted men. A theory we can't afford to dismiss.
The name, Brogan said vacantly, it strikes a chord.
You've heard it before?
Suddenly Brogan's brows raised and his eyes widened ever so slightly, and he reached for his intercom. Send up the latest file from the French Internal Security Agency.
You think you've got something?
A recorded conversation between President Antonov and his KGB chief Vladimir Polovoy. I believe Lugovoy was mentioned.
From French intelligence? Amit asked.
Antonov was on a state visit. Our friendly rivals in Paris are quietly cooperative about passing along information they don't consider sensitive to their national interests. In less than a minute, Brogan's private secretary knocked on the door and gave him a transcription of the secret tape recording. He quickly consumed its contents.
This is most encouraging, he said. Read between the lines and you can invent all sorts of Machiavellian schemes.
According to Polovoy, the UN psychologist disappeared off the Staten Island ferry in New York and all contact was severed.
The KGB lost several sheep from their herd at one time, Emmett asked in mild astonishment.
That's a new twist. They must be getting sloppy.
Polovoy's own statement. Brogan held out the transcript papers.
See for yourself.
Emmett read the typed print and reread it. When he looked up, a trace of triumph brightened his eyes.
So the Russians are behind the abduction.
Brogan nodded in agreement. From all appearances, but they can't be in it alone, not if they're ignorant of Lugovoy's whereabouts. Another source is working with them, someone here in the United States with the power to dictate the operation.
You? Emmett asked wolfishly.
Brogan laughed.
No. And you?
Emmett shook his head.
If the KGB, the CIA, and the FBI are all kept in the dark, then who's dealing the cards?
The person they refer to as the old bitch and Chinese whore.
No gentlemen, these communists.
The code word for their operation must be Huckleberry Finn. Emmett stretched out his legs, crossing them at the ankles, and sagged comfortably in his chair.
Huckleberry Finn, he repeated, enunciating every syllable.
Our counterpart in Moscow has a dark sense of humor. But what's important, he's unwittingly given us an eye to shove a sharp stick into.
No one paid any attention to the two men seated comfortably in a pickup truck parked in a loading zone by the Numa building. A cheap, plastic, removable sign adhered to the passenger's door advertised Gus Moore's Plumbing. Behind the cab in the truck's bed, several lengths of copper pipe and an assortment of tools lay in casual disorder. The men's coveralls were stained with dirt and grease, and neither had shaved in 3 or 4 days. The only odd thing about their appearance was their eyes. They never shifted from the entrance to Numa's headquarters. The driver tensed and made a directional movement with a nod of his head.
I think this is him coming.
The other man raised a pair of binoculars wrapped in a brown paper bag with the bottom torn out and gazed at a figure emerging from the revolving glass doors. Then he laid the glasses in his lap and examined a face in a large 11-by-14-inch glossy photograph.
Confirmed.
The driver checked a row of numbers on a small black transmitter, counting 140 seconds from now. He punctuated his words by pushing a toggle switch to the on position.
Okay, his partner said. Let's get the hell away.
Pitt reached the bottom of the broad stone steps as the plumber's truck drove past in front of him. He stood a moment to let another car by and began walking through the parking lot. He was 70 yards from the Talbot Lago when he turned at the honking of a horn. Al Giordino drew up alongside in a Ford Bronco four-wheel drive. His curly black hair was shaggy and uncombed, and a heavy growth covered his chin. He looked as if he hadn't slept in a week.
"Sneaking home early?" he said.
"I was until you caught me," Pitt replied, grinning.
"Lucky you, sitting around with nothing to do."
"You wrapped the Eagle salvage?" Pitt asked. Giordino gave a tired nod. "Towed her up the river and pushed her into dry dock about 3 hours ago. You can smell her death stink a mile away. At least you didn't have to remove the bodies."
"No, a Navy diving team was stuck with that ugly chore."
"Take a week off. You've earned it." Giordino spread his Roman smile.
"Thanks, boss. I needed that."
Then his expression turned solemn.
"Anything new on the pilot town?"
"We're zeroing in." Pitt never finished the sentence. A thunderous explosion tore the air. A ball of flame erupted between the densely packed cars, and jagged metal debris burst in all directions. A tire and wheel, the chrome spokes flashing in the sun, flew in a high arc and landed with a loud crunch in the middle of Giordino's hood. Bouncing inches over Pitt's head, it then rolled through a landscaped parkway before coming to rest in a cluster of rose bushes. The rumble from the blast echoed across the city for several seconds before it finally faded and died.
"God!" Giordino rasped in bewildered awe. "What was that?"
Pitt took off running, dodging between the tightly parked cars, until he slowed and halted in front of a scrambled mass of metal that smoldered and coughed up a cloud of dense black smoke. The asphalt underneath was gouged and melting from the heat, turning into a heavy sludge. The tangled wreck was nearly unrecognizable as a car. Giordino ran up behind him.
"Jesus, whose was it?"
"Mine," said Pitt. His features twisted in bitterness as he stared at the remains of the once beautiful Talbot Lago.